You know, a shooter came to CDC and shot over 500 rounds of bullets. You know, each one meant for a person. I saw the number in the programs that were going to be terminated. Couldn't sleep. Woke up the next morning, walked into the agency and told my political team I was leaving that day. Maternal mortality. That program isn't functioning right now at CDC. Smoking cessation has also been cut. Measles and vaccines. We're already seeing that. Last year, we had to cancel a flu vaccination campaign during one of the worst flu seasons. There's been whooping cough cases in Louisiana where babies are dying, young kids are dying. There was a lead outbreak in April in Milwaukee, and we didn't have the staff because they'd been fired at that time. And it's not something you can rebuild quickly. And I'm very concerned that should there be, I shouldn't say should there be, when there is the next health threat, we will not be prepared.
Hello, hello.
There.
How's it going?
I'm okay. You?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I'm lying. I'm not very good. I watched some of your testimony, and I over COVID, I did a lot of like vaccine and COVID related arguments. So now I just get insanely triggered anytime anything comes up related to it. So how are you doing today?
It's been a morning.
It's been a morning.
It's been a morning.
For my audience, it doesn't know who you are. So I believe your last name is pronounced Oury, correct? Deborah Oury? Yeah.
Yes.
You've been working in, or was working in some capacity with the CDC since, well, I was going to say 2014, but not, is the, I suck at the government things. What was the body that you worked for in 2014? Was that under the CDC or was that part of a different branch of like the HHS or whatever?
No, I was at CDC beginning 2014 at the Injury Center.
Okay. The Injury Center is under the CDC. Yeah. Gotcha. And then you resigned along with a few other people when Trump basically fired, or it was, I guess, RFK fired the CDC director. And then we've watched some of your testimony on that. Part of your role at the CDC was doing kind of public communication with science, with medical information. And yeah, we had a mutual friend connect us, and I just want to like communicating scientific stuff and communicating where the research is at and communicating where the recommendations should be on public health is a huge area of interest for me. So yeah, I just wanted to chat and ask you some questions about that. Yeah.
Sounds good.
I guess my first question on the broadest level, one of the big challenges over like the COVID time period, especially, was figuring out like what should the role of government be in communicating to anybody. What do you think the CDC's role should be insofar as like public communication, communicating with social media platforms, advising the president or whatever? Like what do you think is what is like the optimal role?
Yeah, and you know, even taking a step back, you know, mm-hmm. I was an ER doc for, you know, like 10 plus years. And so for me, it's always been about like, how do you communicate to patients and make sure everybody gets what they need? And so CDC, I viewed patients as the population. Uh-huh. And so CDC's role should be about communicating health issues or health threats to the population and what they need to protect themselves. I think when it comes to things like social media, it's, you know, how do you have kind of bite-sized information that consumers can use, but realizing federal government can be clunky, right? You know, so like CDC is not what you want, like on, you know, Twitter all the time, other than, you know, some information. I think that's where you have to look at using, you know, trusted messengers and getting out into communities more to have a lot more communication and looking for other ways to communicate. You know, they do scientific publications, but not everybody's going to read one of those, you know, very dense publications. So then finding ways to talk to the public, whether it's a press briefing or doing interviews like this, where people can understand and ask questions, I think is really important.
I'm curious, you brought up the term trusted figures. What do you mean when you say that? Like members of the government that are public facing and recognizable, like people like Fauci? Or do you mean like having like podcasters or people that go around and do public messaging? Or yeah,
I would say all of the above, probably usually less political figures, you know, but more like, you know, if you're a church member, you know, a school teacher, a podcaster, like who people listen to and have a relationship with. Is, or, you know, primary care doctor or pediatrician, those are who people are going to be more likely to listen to when it comes to things. When it comes to health, usually their own doctor they will listen to. But a lot of times, like during COVID, we knew people wanted to know what their neighbors were doing, what their families were doing, what their, you know, churches or synagogues were doing. And so really ensuring that it was happening much more through communities.
Is there a role now when it seems like there's so much kind of mistrust being fostered? Yes. In a lot of these or in a lot of these alternative communities, is there a role for the CDC to have an active line of communication to these people, or is there like a worry that it automatically becomes tainted if somebody sees that like the CDC is involved? Like, what do you think the combating that looks like going forward?
Yeah, I think, at CDC, people should be willing to talk to any partner. When I was at CDC, I used to tell my staff if a partner reached out, and initially they were like, "Oh, we don't have time, or we're not going to do it." I said, "Well, then I'll do it," And so then they're like, "Nope, we'll do it." I just think you should always at least hear what a partner has to say. You may not agree, but you might also learn something.
Okay. Do you think that we live in, as we go through time, there's always this like, now is the worst time ever, or this is the worst thing ever.
Yeah.
Do you think we live in an era of exceptional mistrust in kind of like government institutions, or do you think these things kind of like come and go, or?
From what I have seen, this seems like a really exceptional time in a bad way for mistrust. And I would say part of that's because, the person I used to, work two levels below, the secretary, was promoting misinformation and saying things like, "Don't trust the experts." So, like, if you're saying that, then it's hard to listen to what the experts say.
Do you, I guess I'm trying to think of one of the frustrations that I have is that when I'm communicating with people, generally, if there's like mainstream information coming from like a scientific body or from a huge government organization, the boring answer is generally it's pretty verified because there's a lot of people that are looking at it. It's been through the rigmarole. There's just a lot of stuff backing it up. But one issue that I'm having now as I'm communicating with people is, so I've had this position a lot where I'm like, well, listen, if the CDC says this, if these people make this recommendation, it's probably true, right? You're probably safe to accept that. And increasingly, as of I think this morning now, the statement is like, vaccines haven't been proven to not cause autism, which I don't know if you ever make a negative like proving thing like that ever in any scientific literature. But now as I'm looking at the CDC and now when there are guidelines coming out that are hard to trust, I have to curtail that advice a lot. I've got to be very careful when I say, well, I don't know if I necessarily trust them. But obviously for the next administration, well, hopefully, I'm saying obviously, hopefully, if things go a little bit back to normal, I can get back to that. Well, we can kind of trust our institutions when they say these things. How do you navigate, or I guess how would you recommend somebody navigate, maybe you personally or your recommendations to other people, like when trust is being lost in certain institutions, I guess like how do you navigate that environment in the future? I could be more specific if you need. It's kind of general, but yeah.
Yeah, I think what's tough is like when it takes like a minute to lose trust, but then it takes so much longer to rebuild trust. And so, even if there is a change, in a secretary or an administration, it's going to take much longer than just a change to rebuild trust. And this didn't happen overnight. I was actually speaking to a bunch of health journalists yesterday, and they said, so what can we trust on the CDC website? And one of my colleagues said, "I wouldn't trust things on vaccines." And I jumped in and I said, "Honestly, I'm going to say that there's other things we shouldn't trust going forward." I said, "If there's any updates on autism," and I gave a few other examples. I said, "I wouldn't necessarily trust those." Didn't know it was going to happen last night, but I didn't resign as kind of like a last minute idea. I had been thinking about for months and really kind of pushing back against some of the misinformation and some of the things that I were worried were going to harm people, like wrong information on measles, allowing protected information on vaccine safety to people that weren't qualified to have it. And so when we reached that tipping point, I'd hoped the CDC director was going to be able to protect against some of that. When it was clear she couldn't, I knew that I, from a scientific integrity, like your integrity and your reputation is all you have. And so that's why I predicted that this would continue to worsen at CDC.
One of the things you mentioned, this is a frustrating thing for me, is this the idea of you say you can lose trust in an instance. Why do you think, in your opinion, so I'll argue against people who will say, the most common one is like, well, Fauci said don't wear masks, and then he said wear masks or whatever. They'll look at like a hotly evolving situation where, information can change, or somebody might legitimately make a mistake or whatever. And it seems like you said, the trust is very easy to lose. But the people who are the most critical on the other side, who are giving reasons for why you shouldn't trust these, large institutions, the CDC, the FDA, the NIH, they'll make incorrect statements all the time, and they never seem to lose any trust on their side, which is very strange. How do you combat that asymmetry?
Yeah, I don't know if you can. I think it's just one of those things, just knowing that if you are in, a government or a leadership type position, that there is kind of that differential standard. And I think being more upfront, one of the things I learned, in communication training around risk communication, saying what you know, what you don't know. And certainly if you learn something differently, really be upfront about it. And I think it's more of, being a lot more humble, when we're talking to people. And that's when I put on my ER doc hat. I'm like, I need to refer you to a specialist, or here's what I know today. And if I get more data, or if that X-ray comes back different, I might change what I say.
Gotcha. There, on a personal level, the there's a challenge between being, I would say, intellectually honest, but having strong rhetoric. So I'm pretty honest when I don't know a thing, but if I'm willing to hedge appropriately with, like, well, I think or I feel I'm about 50% sure of this, but my adversary in a conversation is willing to stake out a much stronger claim rhetorically to the audience. Well, this guy seems like he knows what he's talking about. The other guy seems like he's clueless. It seems, yeah, it's frustrating with the combination of factors of any one mistake, or even not a mistake, but as information changes, any one thing that changes is like an instant huge red mark against a large institution. But then for other individuals, and there are still a lot of them are still pushing ivermectin, still pushing hydroxychloroquine as these cure, now they're cure-alls, I guess, for every disease. And it's so annoying that it feels like there's never a mark against their credibility or reputation when it comes to making these same recommendations, and they don't hedge anything at all. They'll go from one extreme statement to the next. I might just be venting. I don't know if there's a question there, but yeah, that asymmetry it seems very frustrating, very difficult to deal with.
Agree.
Yeah, well, I guess on that level, one thing that I'm kind of noticing, and the winds are changing a little bit on this. I don't know if it's good or bad. I believe I would say that spiritually, if you're a member of the government, a member of the executive branch, generally speaking, the job should be apolitical, right? The CDC, everybody, yeah. But when other people want to make everything very political on the right, I was trying to be apolitical, but I don't know. When the conservatives seem right now, they're very invested in being very political when they attack one side. And then when the institutions come out and they try to be very apolitical, I wonder sometimes if the impression that that's giving is one of an inability or an unwillingness to defend that side, as strongly as it should be. Does that make sense?
It does. What I'm wrestling with though is when I was speaking to several congressional members a couple months ago around the time of my resignation, I said to one of them, "I'm apolitical," and he just said, "Deb, this isn't politics. This is ideology." And that was from a Republican senator, and that really stuck with me. And I was like, "You're right. Like if we're talking about saving lives and health, it shouldn't be political. Certainly, there can be different spectrums of it." But I look at what happened last night, and the secretary literally is trolling Senator Cassidy right now. This the secretary is. He put an asterisk on this updated website saying, "I'm keeping this title here because I promised the senator that." But then he changed the rest of the website. And so that's infighting within, a single political party at this point.
Is it one? This is kind of personal, kind of with the CDC. One thing I've heard a lot in the past is for people that work at government agencies, that they're surprisingly apolitical, like the day-to-day workforce. A lot of people from FBI, CIA, government people will email me and they'll tell me this. I've heard as of recently this year, I've had some of those same people and other people have said the jobs have gotten surprisingly more political. That like low-level employees, frontline people are now openly discussing politics more. It seems to be a little bit more pervasive in the workplace. Was that your impression, or do you think it's still relatively apolitical, or has it changed a little? Or?
I think it's still relatively apolitical. I think certainly, the workplace, as you get to know people, people will just, tell you what they think about things or if there was something on the news. But I reminded people during the first Trump administration, because I had many people just assume, that everybody, voted, Democrat. And I said, obviously that didn't happen here in Georgia, since, we have, a Republican president. And I said, so you shouldn't presume to know who all your colleagues are around you and their beliefs. I would say in general, when you're focusing on just on things like data, or clinical guidance, really shouldn't be political. And I think one of the things I was proudest of when I was, the injury center director was I got firearm violence research funded under the Trump administration, by talking about suicide prevention, protecting young kids like from unintended consequences, things like that. So if you can find that common ground, it becomes apolitical. So at CDC and other government agencies, if it's become political, it might just be because like we had more political appointees than normal. When I left, I was the only career, and there were 13 political appointees with me in the office as director compared to the normal 2 to 3.
Jeez. Okay. Kind of on that mention, how you can find like common ground with people. I'm kind of curious from like a personal or maybe from a scientific recommendation standpoint. Sometimes there are people who are just like in a epistemically in a totally different world. But I remember one of the jokes I made about RFK Jr. was that there was a world where, despite how much just crazy stuff I would say this guy believes in, there's a world where, in a roundabout way, people end up becoming a lot healthier just because of some of the recommendations that he would make related to like exercise is good. Everybody knows that exercise is good. Or like this obsession with certain diets or whatever, or ultra processed foods might just cut down on the amount of junk that people are eating, which is a good thing. How do you build a bridge, or do you build a bridge and agree with some parts of a person if, like, their core kind of like engine or driver is so fundamentally flawed? Is there like a risk in that, or like, is that like a deal with the devil, or how do you see that, I guess?
You know, for me, like when the secretary was coming on board, in my mind, he was coming. So you got to work with him. And I was actually the transition lead for the agency, meaning I was the one that oversaw like how we would, bring in the new administration. So we look for exactly what you're saying, those priorities like around food and water and ending chronic disease and where there could be alignment with him. I had actually read several of his books before he started to try to figure out where our priorities align. The one thing I would just say as a side note is I was disappointed that in his books, many of his references like were of retracted stories or Snopes, and so that gave me a little bit of pause, but I still was trying to figure out where we could have alignment. And if he could advance on a couple priorities together, that would have been great. He just chose never to meet with us.
Gotcha. Do you think that there is a like that Americans might now might be a little bit below the threshold of the understanding needed for how government functions to be able to have real conversations about the government? So like for instance, I saw one of the questions you got a lot was, why does the CDC force us to get vaccinated? Yeah, and then sometimes when you're talking to Americans, it's like with the stuff relating to the Department of Education. It wouldn't surprise me if over half of America thought that the Department of Education like mandates curriculum K through 12 in every state. It wouldn't surprise me if half of America thought that. Is that a thing that the CDC on its own can combat just when it comes to like scientific stuff? Or do you think this is a whole like some kind of civic education overhaul? Or what does that look like?
I do think it's broader. I think it's a civic education overhaul. And certainly, each agency can try to speak more about what they do and don't do. But when I use kind of jargony language and we'll say something like, well, CDC is not a regulatory agency, people say, well, what does that mean? And so like, oh, no. Well, we're actually regulatory when it comes to looking at like cruise ships and sanitation, but we're not for this. That just makes it really hard to understand. And it's also easy. I remember, when we passed one guideline around, prescribing opioids, I had colleagues saying, yeah, we knew it wasn't mandatory, but we would point to the CDC because, it's like when you're a parent, like, and you want to just say something, it's easier to say, well, the school made me do it, or something like that. And so sometimes I feel, other organizations might point to the CDC because it's just easier to kind of shift to somebody else. But I do think we can, as a nation, better understand, what is the role of government in these different agencies and what do they do and don't do? Because that way, if there is an issue, you can actually address where the issue is at.
Do you think that I guess it wouldn't be happening now, but like if you could make huge changes to how the CDC does communication, like what would some of those changes look like?
Yeah, and I would say, what is sad to me is after COVID, there were so many lessons learned. Like there were certainly issues around lab, and being ready for responses. CDC rose to the occasion. Like we did a like whole staff effort called Moving Forward to where we looked at lab quality and made sure that staff were ready for responses. And so with communication, we worked on that too. We started doing things called like clinical pearls that we would send out to doctors so they could understand some of the takeaways. On the website, there were more data dashboards. So you could go and see what in your community was for measles. And then we started doing things like, more regular media briefings, putting out press summaries, and trying to use, as you and I were talking about, like some of these trusted messengers to carry messages on things like flu campaigns. So I think we were starting to move forward on that. And I think that's where you need to work a lot with private sector and others too, because you don't want the same talking heads doing it all. You got to have creativity being brought in.
Gotcha. I guess I was maybe disappointed in myself. I didn't realize until pretty late on that the CDC website, towards the end of like 2023, and maybe this was updated earlier, was actually like a fairly useful resource. That when vaccine stuff was there, you guys were like directly linking to studies, and you could look up a question and look at stuff, and it would be right there. And it was actually like a pretty good resource for that. So if that was part of that drive, that was
Yeah, actually,
exciting.
you're, yeah, that's a great point. You know, one of the things we did is we realized the website was so overwhelming with so much material that we reduced more than half of the material on it and tried to have some of those bullet points so people could find out like what's on this website and here's where you go for more information. So that was part of those efforts as well. Unfortunately, in the past couple of months, the website has become much more ideological, which is not what should ever happen, you know, to be evergreen.
What was the when the CDC is evaluating evidence for guidelines, what does it look like, I guess? Maybe in a boring, almost like bureaucratic level, what does that look like? So research comes out, you guys are trying to decide whether or not you would incorporate, mRNA vaccine guidelines or whatever in. Like, what are you looking at? Are you looking at other bodies and what they've determined, like the WHO or other people's, like CDC's? Is this strictly a US process? Like, yeah, what does that look like?
It can be many different things. So one, if you see that other organizations already have guidelines that, you know, look really well researched, sometimes you can just point to those and not reinvent things and just say, we're going to adopt, you know, XYZ guidelines. Other times, if there's a gap where people think it needs to be generated because of the time, the need, or something from the US, you look at what's the evidence to date. So you do like a systematic review, which means you do huge literature searches, you know, of like, how many studies are out there? Then you narrow them down. So, you know, are they randomized controlled trials, meaning, you know, where you have an intervention, you're testing it against an experimental one and one that hasn't been exposed to that intervention, versus, you know, anecdotes or case controls would be towards the bottom of it. And you put most emphasis on the more rigorous studies. And then you try to determine what are the findings from that and how would you then, you know, change guidance or clinical care based on that. So it's not like a just, hey, we're going to change the guidance overnight. Usually there's a significant process to it. And that's what's been disappointing about some of the recent vaccine committee meetings. They've talked about, gosh, we're rookies, you know, or we'll just add something to the agenda when there should be this whole year-long process of reviewing the evidence when there's not an urgent, critical reason to have an update.
For people that review evidence at the CDC, are these like full-time government employees, or do you have boards that are sat on by like research physicians, or where do those people come from, I guess?
Yeah, it's kind of all of the above. So there's, unfortunately, I believe they were part of the October 10th layoffs, but the library was one area to where they would do these long systematic reviews and help staff, you know, pull the evidence around it. We also would have a lot of federal advisory committees, which means bringing external people in, and then the scientists at CDC would help provide a lot of that data and evidence for them. But CDC knew they don't have all the expertise, and oftentimes you need to bring in those outside researchers. But it was done in a very structured format, using what we call GRADE, which is, you know, an acronym about how you really look at the data from the different levels of quality. So all of it was done to minimize bias, to minimize outside conflicts of interest. And that's the other thing. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, CDC with conflicts of interest and getting money from pharma and things like that. So I looked at that about a year ago, when we knew there was going to be a new administration coming in. Extremely few, even patents at CDC, and most of the people that had patents weren't even currently at CDC. Conflicts of interest for things like the vaccine committee, really minimal because they go through a whole process. And then myself and other senior leaders have to disclose, you know, what mutual funds like we even invest in like publicly. So there are very few conflicts of interest and ties with pharmaceutical industry.
How do you respond to people who say things like they'll take this default adversarial position opposite all doctors, all pharmaceuticals, all hospitals? How do you respond? Somebody says, well, of course, big pharma or the hospitals are going to tell you that these drugs work or whatever. That's their job. They get paid for it. How do you respond to that kind of, like, I guess, like broad, mistrust?
Yeah, that's when I just try to ask some follow-up questions. I'll say, huh, that's interesting. That hasn't been my experience. Can you give me a specific example? When you try to drill down a little bit, those generalities, oftentimes there's not much substance to it, other than they'll just keep saying, well, that's what I've heard or that's what I know. And I'd say, happy to address it or look into it, but you got to give me something I can work with.
Gotcha. Okay. I agree with you there 100%. For how do you deal with people who make I'm asking you more like debate or just rhetoric things. I'm just kind of curious. There's also this is, I'm half just venting too. Sometimes you'll hear people say things. This came up in your congressional hearing, and you just mentioned it now that you check for conflict of interest, where people will say, I call these things like level one assertions, where somebody will say things like, "Oh, well, why don't you guys, when you study, you shouldn't let like conflict of interest shouldn't be a thing, because you guys might be biased and Fauci's making billions of dollars because he owns all these interests." And people just don't know like the extensive level of vetting that goes into a lot of government stuff. To step to the education world, I have a few friends that work with like grant programs that work with colleges, and the amount of like hoops that you have to jump through and everything else to get like approved for government funding is just insane. But then if you go to the public, the feeling is just, oh, well, NGOs get free money from the government with zero oversight. And it's like there's so much oversight. It's unbelievable. And then, on the back of this, you'll hear these things, these I call these like truisms. People will say, like, I can't believe kids get 70 or 80 vaccines. It's too many. And it's like, well, what is the appropriate amount? Like, if it was 500 and we reduce it to 100, would you say that's enough? Or if it was 70, should it be 30? Which ones do you want to get rid of?
And how do you break it down? Is it the same methodology or mechanism, now that it was then? And, vaccines right now have, when you look at them, they're done in a much more, I don't want to say cleaner way, but like there's a lot less antigens in them. And so you can actually have more vaccines and there's less of a response. So even though there might be more numbers, there is less reaction to them because the science has evolved. And so I think just being very clear on things like that too, it's really tough because some people will really be set in their ways and don't want to hear. And you have to be willing to change your mind. Like I have to be willing to change my mind too. I know we were looking at one of the vaccines and could we even reduce, the number of doses of it? I thought that was fair to look at, but you have to use data to drive that decision. You can't make the decision first and then try to backfit it because that doesn't help anybody. And I think that's the issue we're seeing right now is people have foregone conclusions and they're trying to force data or science. And that's never what it should be. Science is about learning and exploring.
When the CDC makes recommendations in regards to like the vaccine schedule, some people will point out that some of the vaccines are for diseases that like people are rarely coming into contact with anymore. So in the U.S., things like tuberculosis, or I've heard people criticize like, well, how many people get tetanus, or how deadly is tetanus even, considering how rare and the medical treatments available today. Does the CDC ever reevaluate, or how does the CDC decide that like this is a vaccine that we would recommend on an ordinary child's vaccine schedule? Like, what are they weighing there, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, so I think you look at, what are the treatments available for these diseases? Are they preventable? What are the long-term consequences? And what I would say is, I've seen kids that had measles, that had meningitis. I actually saw a case of tetanus in my residency training. And I can tell you, it was a pretty horrible disease that the person had. I mean, they were on a ventilator spasming, I mean, with high fevers. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. And it's preventable. And so in my mind, if somebody could die or they could have something that would prevent it, we should prevent it. Or at least ensure people are aware of the risks and the benefits of it. CDC does look, over time as to, well, here's an easy one, smallpox, right? It's eradicated, so you don't need to vaccinate for it anymore. So I think you can just look at what's the prevalence of diseases. And there's some vaccines, like yellow fever, we don't give in the US that you get when you're traveling abroad. So I think you just look at what's the, how likely is it that you're going to get in the US versus elsewhere?
Okay. When you mentioned lessons learned, or you mentioned that over COVID, there might be things that could have gone differently. I guess retrospectively, and maybe even prospectively, do you think at the time there were mistakes that were made, or maybe not mistakes, but like, this is a thing that definitely could have been handled better in terms of public communication, in terms of recommendations? And then I guess like going forward, hopefully not under this administration, but in a more responsible one, like how does it look different in another, kind of epidemic environment where the government is trying to put out information quickly but effectively and might have to change guidelines as it goes without losing trust? Like, yeah, what kind of, do you think any mistakes were made and what would you change going forward for those kinds of responses?
Yeah, and I think, you know, to be fair on both sides, like COVID was new, you know, so I mm-hmm. think if it was a pathogen where you knew what was going to happen, you know, it's easier to have guidance and then adapt it. I think, you know, with COVID, people were learning, like, are you infectious when you have symptoms versus when you don't? And so that was something, you know, that was new. And I think it also changed when there were vaccines versus when there weren't vaccines for it, you know, like what your risk levels might be and how you treat yourself. But certainly, I think being much more saying what we knew and what we didn't know and how it changed would have been more helpful. Like the whole thing around, you know, social distancing, you know, and inside versus outside, and really being able to talk more about like, what's the science behind it? What do we know? There's not a lot of studies on it. How are we going to determine that? And it could be that you say something like, because we don't know that much right now and there's no vaccine or treatment, here's what we think we should do to keep you safe. To me, that makes sense. And then when you learn more or there's a vaccine, you can say, hey, now that we know this, we can change this guidance. That makes more sense. So I think really being able to be more comfortable in the gray area versus having everything be so black and white sometimes.
Gotcha. Do you have, when you were working, I guess, for this last year, did you ever feel, I guess, like more like personal pressure insofar as like death threats or public harassment from individuals related to medical stuff, I guess more so in the past, or maybe over COVID, maybe that was when it was at its worst? Or
yeah, I'd say, you know, I've probably over the past 10 years, it's kind of been up and down depending on what topics, you know, I was working on. And even in the ER, I'd have, you know, patient threats or afterwards patients, you know, might try to attack me. But this past year, there's been, I'd say, a lot more personalization, you know, to where people focus on CDC scientists. And the one thing I would say is, you know, CDC was violently attacked in August. You know, a shooter came to CDC and shot over 500 rounds of bullets. You mm-hmm. know, each one meant for a person, took out 180 different windows. Yes, so I think that's where a lot of staff did feel very personally targeted and threatened.
Gotcha.
Not just by a name, but like because you're associated with CDC.
Yeah. I think that got all of like 3 days of coverage and then we moved on to the next thing. But that was pretty crazy. I think it was a couple months ago, right? A few months ago.
August 8th.
I don't remember. Did they find like his social media and everything for what was driving this guy?
Yeah, my understanding from some of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation reports was that the person believed that he had been injured by a COVID vaccine and was angry at the CDC for that.
One of the things you bring up, the vaccine injury. So one of the things I used to always feel is that sometimes people will over-index on anecdotal information. Yes. Something that I feel that has kind of like happened over the past few years is something else is happening where even the anecdotal stuff is not changing people's minds. I had a debate with a couple guys who wanted to get into the vaccine injury stuff. And I think I remember asking them, I was like, do you even know anybody who was vaccine injured? And I think they had like one example, and it was like, we bought a car at a car dealership and the car dealer guy was saying that his daughter was vaccine injured or something. I was like, okay. And then I was like, do you guys know anybody that died of COVID? And they're like, oh yeah, like 3 or 4 people. And I'm like, what is the difference? I don't understand. Like, it seems like if anything was like anecdotally moving you in a direction, it feels like the people actually dying of COVID would. And then also anecdotally, and I guess just like looking around, you know, the media, like we were told for years that there were going to be mass deaths, mass blood clots, mass, like everybody that was vaccinated was going to basically drop dead or their bodies were going to explode or something was going to happen. Stringy things would be pulled out of them. And nothing came of that. I guess it feels like there's like an impenetrable wall. I know I have a lot of physician friends and stuff who will have family members that will tell them they don't know what they're talking about. And it's like, mom, I went to medical school for this. I work in internal medicine. I'm a cardiologist. Like, what's going on? It feels like it's very, very, very hard sometimes, even on a personal level, to break through to people, to get through a lot of the misinformation that's kind of floating out there on these alternative media platforms these days.
Yeah, it can be. And that's where I try to personalize it a little bit, you know, not too much because I like to, you know, keep people around me safe. But I'll just say things like, I'm a mom, I'm a wife, I'm a daughter, I'm a scientist and a doctor, and I chose to get people that I care about vaccinated, just to try to let people know that, I'm human, I've got humans around me, and that, I personally get vaccinated. I make sure my family members do. And then I found that data is not enough, so like you have to talk about the data, but then also pair it with, gosh, this prevented, this many number of people from being hospitalized, or I had a colleague who pre-vaccine now has long COVID because they were in the ER and exposed to so much, and now used to be a marathon runner, now can't even see patients on shift because they're so tired. Gosh, I wish we'd had a vaccine to have prevented that.
Do you, on a on another, I guess, a kind of personal level, when you one question my audience has had, and I've kind of had it, and I give an explanation, but I'm not sure if it's correct. Sometimes when big events happen, big firings happen. This happened in the Southern District of New York when it came to prosecutor stuff related to Eric Adams. Instead of people kind of like staying and fighting within the admin, people decide to resign. Sometimes they'll write a public letter and make a statement. What goes into that decision of like, I'm going to resign and make a statement instead of staying to continue to give your input or staying and fighting in the position? Yeah, how do you weigh that, or how do you make that decision personally?
Yeah, I said for me it was an extremely tough decision, and I actually was given a list of I saw the number and the programs that were going to be terminated end of March, and I saw that list, couldn't sleep, woke up the next morning, walked into the agency, and told my political team I was leaving that day. I actually couldn't do that to the agency; wouldn't be part of it. I got to meet Doge that way. I got to join on Zoom and talk about why I thought some of these programs were important. Was able to appeal. And so I did stay after that and thought. But what I found was I realized the second you say you're going to walk out the door, that it could actually happen. And they could have said, okay, go that way. So I wrote a resignation letter later that week just because I wanted to, if I ever do leave or did leave, to have it be on my terms with what I wanted to say and to have thought through it and not be a rash decision. So I fought for 4+ months there. I was given things like a measles toolkit, asked to put medications on it that aren't approved for measles and don't have evidence for it, in my mind, could cause harm. We were asked to approve the COVID guidance the secretary tweeted out that we had never seen, that was like on a video. And we had to ask, show us like what the memo is. And the memo that they produced didn't match the video. And I'm like, I can't just provide guidance for the nation without like rationale and data. And there kept being decisions like that that over time got tougher and more of them. And so, Dan Dimitri and I realized that we were fighting, for probably the last month. It was really tough. And that's when the CDC director was also told, she'd been there all of, I think, 2 weeks, that she wasn't going to be able to make any staffing or policy decisions without approval. And a leader can't do that. And so I knew that I didn't have a scientific leader at that point. And so we decided that the best way we could fight was from outside, because then we could use our voices more.
Okay. Oh, because while working in the administration, you're probably a lot more limited in terms of what you're
Yes.
allowed to say publicly. Gotcha.
Very limited.
Do one personal frustration I have is I feel like sometimes people don't realize, especially working in the media side of things and knowing other people that work in the media side of things, I feel like people don't realize sometimes how passionate but also underpaid a lot of government work is. I had a friend that worked at the Kennedy Space Center, I believe, and he was talking about a lot of the DOGE cuts for the letters that went out to get people to retire. And the way that he explained it to me was that all of the old guys working there could have made way more money in the private sector, but they loved working for stuff related to NASA. It was just like a lifelong passion for them. And that overwhelmingly, the people that took these buyouts were just young people because they were like, oh, cool, I was here for a year. I'm getting a 8-month severance. I could take a vacation and then get a job afterwards. And that, they were just bleeding all the new talent out because of the people that were there and established, like, didn't really want to leave. And the I guess like the framing that, like Fauci is now a billionaire and all the people at the CDC had huge shares in whatever bio lab company was in Ukraine that was manufacturing the COVID-19, whatever. Yeah, it's very frustrating that the same people making those criticisms on the media side of things are at least like 7-figure jobs, 8 figures, depending on how big they are in media. And the fact that that you guys have so many built-in things for like checking for conflict of interest and
Yes.
remaining transparent. And sometimes people will come up and be like, I wish you guys would just be more open about this. Like, we've been doing this for decades. Like, we already are open about this. Just the information out there is just so frustrating. It feels like when I have to start a conversation with somebody, I'm having to fight through so much bullshit just to get to a neutral platform where we can even start to have a conversation, you know?
And you know, when I resigned, I'm still figuring out what I'm going to do next. You know, like I didn't have all those conflicts of interest that, you know, people think we do. And so, you know, it was a difficult decision, you know, to decide to do that just from a, you know, personal financial standpoint too. But you have to be able to sleep at night. And I also didn't want to hurt the American public.
For one of the things that a lot of people are thinking right now on the left, I guess, is if assuming the government comes back, or people that are just unhappy with how a lot of the executive administrations have been kind of, or how the administration has ruined a lot of these executive agencies, or that they're perceived to ruin. I don't know why I'm trying to say this apolitically. They've messed with a lot of these. Some people are thinking we need to have different laws, or we need to have different federal rules. We need to build in more guidelines to prevent this type of stuff going forward. And my perspective or position on it is more like you can't really create like a perfect rule set if people have come in and decided that they just don't want to follow the rules. Because sometimes people are doing things that are already expressly against the rules.
That's what I was going to say, is there's already a lot of those processes in place. They're just not being followed. You know, when you look at even things around the advisory committee, you know, there's time for public comment. You're supposed to post things in advance. You're supposed to, you know, minimize conflicts of interest. That hasn't happened like it did prior. Usually, you know, you would ensure that there's continuity in an agency, that there's a, you know, principal deputy or a chief medical officer that who could step in as acting director. And we had a whole continuing operations plan, but the secretary chose not to implement that. I would have been, you know, the acting CDC director when Dr. Menares was off waiting to be confirmed, but he didn't appoint anybody during that time. He would step in and sign things. So there are processes in place. It's just you have to choose to follow them. So I don't think more rules are necessarily the answer.
Looking forward, if somebody wanted to make the argument that the things that are happening at the CDC or with a lot of executive agencies are really bad, but particularly with our medical stuff, with our recommendations for, epidemiological things, what would be things looking, forward that you could say, when we defund these things, when we are lax on these things, here are bad outcomes that we can expect going forward that you can kind of look towards and predict now, so that hopefully in 2 to 4 years you can say, look, there are more measles, there's more whatever else. This is why we need to have these things. What are like some indicators, I guess, that you could give somebody to kind of like harp on,
Yeah, the whole spectrum. What I'd say is like one, I can look at like what's already lost. So like we lost the concussion program at CDC. That does all of the training for almost all of the coaches, you know, for high schools. So going forward, many coaches will not be trained to look at concussion for kids and won't know how to recognize it. And you know, all of those athletes out there, that's going to result in, you know, more traumatic brain injury, more, you know, issues. Maternal mortality, that program isn't functioning right now at CDC. Smoking cessation has also been cut. And so people are going to start smoking again. We're going to see rates of cancer rise. All of that is cheaper to prevent. Maternal mortality is devastating in this country. And if we aren't working with hospitals tracking it and intervening it, more young moms and babies will die. As you mentioned, with like measles and vaccines, we're already seeing that with, you know, increased vaccine hesitation. Last year, we had to cancel a flu vaccination campaign during one of the worst flu seasons. So we're going to see more people die of flu, of measles. We had a polio case a few years ago. People aren't getting vaccinated. We're going to see that. There's been whooping cough cases in Louisiana where babies are dying, young kids are dying. We're going to see more and more of that. And then if you even look at things like lead, there was a lead outbreak in April in Milwaukee, and we didn't have the staff because they'd been fired at that time to respond to communities to provide that support. Fortunately, that was one of the programs that was reinstated, but you can't fire and reinstate programs when you need them. You need continuous support for public health.
I think One of the frustrating things is the when something is active and working, it's not very visible, and sometimes it can be tempting to say, "Oh, well, we don't need this and this and this. We can just cut this." And it's like, "Well, why don't we need this?" "Well, because we don't have these problems." Like, "Why don't you think we have these problems?" If there was a, what are like the biggest pieces of stuff that you wish that people would know, maybe epidemiologically about public health, or maybe about the CDC, that you wish like more like other people outside of the CDC were harping on? Like you're listening to Joe Rogan, or you're listening to Theo Von or some podcast, you're like, I wish that they knew this, or I wish that they'd stop saying this because this is like so wrong. Like, what are the like top like three pieces of things that you're like, God, I hate that people still believe this thing?
Yeah, I think one of the things is I would hear like they need to get back to their original mission of only infectious disease. Well, like public health and health doesn't work like that, you know, and infectious disease is linked with chronic disease. During COVID, we saw the people that got sickest had other chronic diseases. During Zika, you know, we needed environmental health to know, you know, how to spray for mosquitoes. We needed reproductive health specialists to understand the birth defects that were happening, you know, as well as sexually transmitted infection specialist, because it was then being, you know, transmitted that way. You needed all of those disciplines together. And I would say the other thing is Congress has appropriated those dollars. So it's not like the people just switched from one thing to another. Specialists were brought in for that. So it wasn't mission drift. I think the other thing is, you know, people will say it doesn't work. You know, you haven't ended chronic disease yet, you know, so obviously you're ineffective. Well, when you look at the amount of funding that goes into prevention versus what goes into treatment and recovery, prevention is extremely minimal funding. And so there's actually more focus on prevention and then ending chronic disease. We wouldn't need as much for treatment. And so I think it's just being able to really look at those returns on investment. And then,
I will say real quick on that, something that's very frustrating because I don't even know this unless somebody brings up my attention. There has been a lot of progress on different diseases that a lot of people just aren't aware of. Even things that people complain a lot about. I know a lot about like type 1 and type 2 diabetics, like the advancements in insulin and these like continuous glucose monitors and all the and the automatic pumps for type 1 diabetics. The advancement in HIV, retrovirals is
Yes.
insane. The all-cause mortalities for things like leukemias and I think all cancer might have just passed like 50% or something on the 5-year or whatever. I think we're on like the precipice of having drugs to treat things like Alzheimer's disease.
Yes.
But it feels like as soon as like a thing gets found, it's like forgotten, and then they just move to the next complaint. Like these GLP-1 agonists are amazing, and the to see that like the origination for them was like trying to isolate a hormone in like a barracuda fish or something. I was like a really random thing that you would never, or I would never think or whatever. And then to see all of that funding get cut, and it's like you guys are all using these drugs now, and then you're trying to defund all of this stuff in the future, and it's so frustrating. I saw the I don't know if you know who is it. Have you heard the name Scott Adams or Adam Scott? He was the
Okay.
comic book author for Dilbert. He's a very MAGA
Oh,
guy
yes.
on
No,
X.
Dilbert.
Yeah. But he's an insanely MAGA guy, and to see him tweet out and beg Trump and RFK to help hook him up with like an experimental no
Oh,
reason.
I saw that. I did see that. Yes.
And I'm
Yeah.
like, yeah, and the same guy, obviously everybody's leaking his tweets about like, oh wow, we just cut all of this experimental research funding. I'm sure this saved exactly 0 people. And it's like, my God, like how, like where's the shame? Yeah, the advancement is there. It's just hard to see sometimes. Do you think that how do you view the USAID cuts? Is this like a totally separate thing from the CDC's mission in your mind, or do you think that there's some interplay between, you know, like international aid and disease monitoring stuff and the CDC, or?
Yeah, no, there's definitely, I'd say we used to collaborate closely with USAID. In country, CDC had people in over 60 countries. Yeah, so oftentimes we would work with USAID, and USAID supported the President's Malaria Initiative, you know, which, you know, prevents malaria from coming to the US, even though we've started to see increases in it. But as we lose that footprint globally, we're going to see cases of Ebola increase. You know, if USAID and CDC aren't there to prevent them, we're going to see Mpox come to the US more. That next pathogen, because there isn't that support in countries, is going to come to the US and we won't be prepared. And it's also when you look at economic development overseas, that's going to have an impact on the US if other countries are having significant outbreaks.
Do you think that when it comes to some of these international relationships, like with the, like say the WHO, are these things that you think can come back in a single administration, or what is that? I guess I don't know if you have context there.
I
What
think
those
the
feel you?
relationships can come back. I think the structures and the agreements and building things will take longer. But finding ways to maintain those ties, with those organizations in the meantime will be important, where we can. I mean, the World Health Organization, we might withdraw funding, but certainly, if there's another outbreak or something, we need to have a relationship to understand, what is the outbreak and what is the risk to the US.
You mentioned that you were happy that you finally got the CDC to study gun violence. I think most people are unaware that, I don't know if it was, there was a bill or something in Congress that in a roundabout way kind of like prohibits the CDC
The
from
Dickey
studying.
Amendment. Well, it prohibited CDC from doing advocacy work on firearms, which CDC wasn't doing. And so, when we did receive the funding for research, it was very clear we had very, focused areas on what we were working on, like, veteran suicide deaths, safe storage, what does that show? Even things like on 4-H, where kids, were doing sports shooting, like how do you make sure that they're safe? How do they learn how to handle guns, so that there aren't injuries. And so that's what we were working on. And you look at things like youth violence, and community violence. How can you look at community level approaches to it? Unfortunately, that funding and those staff are all gone now. But that is something when you look at leading causes of death, for younger people, that's a significant one for both homicide and suicide. And so, in my mind, if you can find ways to prevent those deaths, it's really important.
And then I guess one more question I have is it kind of relates to the other one about the biggest pieces of misinformation you see out there. When you see people who are trying to be public health advocates, what are like the most important things that you think that they should focus on? And what are some forms of public health advocacy that you're like, well, I don't think this is effective, or this might be doing more harm than good? I guess when you look at other people advocating outside of like the CDC or anything.
Good question. I'd say right now when it comes to public health advocacy, I think really focusing on things like, vaccines, and these preventable diseases. A lot of people keep talking about measles being, just a self-limited childhood disease, that people used to get and be fine with. Well, no. Some people then die years later from like what we call encephalitis, kids were hospitalized with pneumonia, and severe dehydration. So it's not a harmless disease. And so I think really doing more advocacy work around what are these diseases like and that they're preventable. And then calling out misinformation, I think, is really important. In my job when I was at CDC, I used to send corrections to our leadership team every time the secretary misspoke because trying to support him to say the correct things. Obviously, he didn't read my emails or listen to my talking points, I guess. But like, I think it's important to correct that misinformation. I think the other thing that public health advocates really need to focus on is talking more with those in their communities about each community has different needs. It might be infectious disease. It might be food insecurity. And like, so how do you ensure that people understand where they can go for resources, what they can do. And simple things like blood pressure screening, that is so important if you want to prevent long-term chronic disease. So I think not forgetting some of the fundamentals of prevention, like blood pressure screening, cancer screening, and stopping smoking. Those are like, and exercise, those are some of the fundamental things you can do to prevent cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancer.
I'm trying to think. Do you have any other, oh, here's a random kind of question. How did you view like foreign stuff, influence, I guess, in a negative manner when you guys were at the CDC? Was that a thing that you were ever made aware of that other organization, like intelligence agencies might say there's a push from, from Russia, China, from some country about some disease or medical misinformation? Was that a thing you factored in, or are you just thinking like we just need to message as best as possible, whatever? Like, how do you factor that into everything?
Yeah, in general, we just try to message as much as possible. And then we would work with the other countries just to learn, like what are they seeing in that country? And if there was something around like bots or misreporting here, I mean, we just tried to do what we could with the limited funding, to promote accurate messaging.
Well, I really appreciate the conversation. Do you have anything else you want to say, or any other points you want to bring up, or anything?
I really appreciate y'all having me here for this discussion. I was excited to join and talk with people around public health and how important it is. I think, I have talked a bit about how it should be apolitical. There's certainly politics that always comes into things, but if you're just talking about health and what's needed, you need to focus on, how we can save lives together. And I am very concerned about the ideology that is driving non-scientific principles right now and is really dismantling public health in our country. And it's not something that can rebuild quickly. And I'm very concerned that should there be, I shouldn't say should there be, when there is the next health threat, we will not be prepared. We had started rebuilding post-COVID on lessons learned. There's been a huge backslide now in our country around public health. And when something happens, people unfortunately will suffer and die. And that's a direct consequence of dismantling public health.
Can I ask kind of a personal question on this? I'm curious. I'm 36, almost 37, and I have a feeling right now, but people always do this. It's worse than it's ever been. I have a feeling that things are more political today than they were when I was growing up. That when I say that, I mean like everything is political. The TV shows you watch, whether you go to the gym, the types of foods you eat, like everything is political. And then obviously, this extends to healthcare as well. That it used to be in the domain of like kind of like the far left, not even far left, like the really hippie people were like, I don't trust vaccines. My dad is vaccine injured from the Air Force, and my parents never mistrusted vaccines, although today they don't anymore. They're ride or die MAGA people. Is it actually in your experience, do you feel like every single thing has become more team sports today? Or do you think that everything always has been and it just wasn't as visible before? Or
I feel like it's become more polarized. Like, I think there was always politics, but I feel like now it's become much more extreme. And I've seen that just even with many of the congressional members I've worked with on both sides. I felt people used to be a bit more moderate and centrist. And now I have seen just over time people tend to drift more to the left and the right, which makes it harder to have some of those meeting in the middle conversations.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Okay. Well, we really appreciate it. Maybe we'll talk at some point in the future. Hopefully things change course. I guess we'll see around midterms and next presidential cycle, but we really appreciate the conversation. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us.
My pleasure. Happy to come back anytime.
Yeah. Have a good one.